what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Shot Wake Up. This is your weekly wildfire update. I hope everybody's doing well, and happy and merry December to you. Few things to talk about today. The bulk of the episode, I'm going to be talking about prescribed fire and the hazards involved with it, and provide a conversation or even an argument why hazard pay should be mandatory for these types of activities. And it's not just a pay issue. It's actually a very hazardous thing to do, and I can make the argument that it would save money, I can make the argument that it would help with retention, and I can make the argument that, hey, it's just as hazardous as wildfire. Even these cutting projects that we do, where you're falling large trees and huge amounts of timber in a short period of time in a compressed area, that's incredibly dangerous, and it sometimes can be more dangerous than what you do on a wildfire itself. Now, I understand that there are organizations out there that don't get hazard pay for anything. A lot of state organizations don't provide that. If you're on the federal side, it's kind of different for each agency, but how it looks is if you're on a wildfire, you get hazard pay. If you're not on a wildfire, you don't. And there are some state agencies that provide hazard pay, and they have given reasons why over the last couple years, even mentioned specifically by the governor of Idaho on how providing hazard pay can help with retention and bolster their ranks. And I've talked about it before on the Substack and here on the podcast that Idaho has a major retention problem. They admitted this year that 50% of their workforce was first-year rookies. And the implementation of hazard pay for those state workers was to help with retention. Now, over the last couple weeks, there have been numbers of injuries, and some severe, that have taken place, whether prepping for a prescribed burn or on the prescribed burn itself. These include chainsaw cutting injuries, where they're actually injured by the chainsaw, trees falling on firefighters during prescribed burns and causing very severe injuries here in just the last couple weeks. Just terrain-related injuries where you're burning or you're walking through the green looking for spot fires and, you know, the cliff sloughs out underneath you and you fall 25 feet with a 45-pound pack on your back. So I think the argument is there. And there's folks who will come at me and say, hey, we don't have the budget for this. And that's the argument for a lot of things in everything government, but specifically wildfire for the last two decades. Whenever a suggestion is made to increase pay or provide hazard and things like this or 24-hour pay, it always comes back to a budgetary issue. The argument will also be made that, hey, we should just pay the firefighters a higher wage so we don't have to implement hazard pay. Sure, I'm all for that. And if you're a longtime listener, I've been advocating that for years and years now and have been trying to convince the public and Congress to take that action to increase the pay of wildland firefighters so we don't have to have these arguments over, hey, should we pay them an extra little bit because they're operating chainsaws in a fire environment, but we're just calling it an RX or a prescribed burn so you don't get that. As I've expressed before, the budgetary concerns, that's a hard sell for me because there's just money flying out the door for all sorts of things. And we almost shut the government down because of a debt ceiling and other things like that. But if you actually look at it, since we suspended the debt ceiling this summer, the government's already spent an extra $2.3 trillion above the debt ceiling that they suspended in less than a year. It's been about a half a year, and they've spent almost $2.5 trillion already. So I'm going to start this conversation just covering the injuries that have taken place, a discussion about that, and then get into my points about how it is just as dangerous and hazard pay should be implemented for these types of operations. On the second segment of the show, I'm going to cover another entrapment that happened out in California. A couple shows back on the Substack, I talked about the entrapment that happened in California a little while ago, and since then, another one has occurred. It was kind of a mid-slope on a road type of incident. If you can imagine the train in California, you have all this very thick, tall brush running up along the roadways, and you go out there with an engine or a truck, and you have a 12-foot cut bank on the upside, and you're kind of in a tight spot. And that's taught a lot in Wildland Fire about, you know, you shouldn't try to defend a mid-slope road. You shouldn't try to burn off a mid-slope road unless absolutely necessary. I'm not saying it can't be done, but they advise against it. And these folks weren't really trying to do either of those things. They were in an area that was, you know, you could consider it kind of a decent area before the fire started to run. But then you have trouble and problems with your equipment, and then you can't get the truck started, and now you're stuck. So I'm going to cover that on the later segment, but we'll start today's show with this conversation about hazard pay. The first incident took place in Colorado, and this is the injury that was a chainsaw going into someone's arm. They were doing prescribed fire prep, and if you don't know what that is, you have units, right? Folks get together, they look at a map, they break up sections of projects that you want to get done. We call them units, and then you prep those units before you burn them, and then you can move on to the next one, and you can check your box that it's been done. What do you do when you prep for a burn? Well, you take down snags, you might dig some line, you might limb up trees around the perimeter and cut down trees that might be a problem during your burn. Now, why would a tree be a problem during a burn? It's supposed to be all contained and super nice. Well, sometimes trees start on fire, and trees that you don't want to start on fire can start on fire. And then it starts showering embers outside of your burn unit. And so what do? You grab someone and you say, hey, we need you to cut that tree down. So on prescribed fires, you could be cutting down very large compromised trees that are on fire. To me, that sounds like a hazardous job. So out in Colorado, this injury, they say it was part of a burn unit preparation on the Stringtown Gulch prescribed fire on the Arapahoe Roosevelt National Forest. A sawyer received a chainsaw cut to the left forearm after experiencing saw kickback during a tree felling operation. The sawyer was transported via ground ambulance to Loveland, Colorado. So just a normal day getting paid base wage, and you're cutting trees down and bucking something up or making a cut, and your saw kicks back, which happens all the time. Well, that saw decided it wanted to find its way into the forearm of this individual and sliced him open like a fish. Again, to me, that sounds quite hazardous. Then there was the injury that took place down in Arizona. This was an employee that was hit by a tree while conducting prescribed fire operations. What were they doing? Well, they were falling a tree, just like I talked about earlier. It says, as part of a burn unit prep in which they were doing snag mitigation on the East Eagle Mud Springs prescribed fire on the Apache Sitgraves National Forest down in Arizona, a sawyer was struck by a portion of a dead aspen tree with two tops. Now, if you don't know, aspen trees, deciduous tree, a leafy tree, very heavy. These are very, very heavy hardwoods, and if you get struck even by a small branch of one of these things, that can cause a lot of problems. So it says this aspen tree had two tops, so it was a fork-top tree. That's a hazardous tree to fall. It says, as the faller completed the cut, the tree fell to the desired lay, but when it hit the ground, one of the tops came back and struck the sawyer. On the ground, the sawyer was in pain, complaining of both leg and back pain, and was tended to by a qualified EMT on scene. Now, if you're conducting a prescribed fire, and one of the requirements is to have medical personnel and EMTs on scene, you would think that you would describe that as a hazardous environment. You know, how many people out there who aren't first responders that are listening, you're required to have an EMT at your job? You know, if you work a desk job or you work at a corporation or a company, in a restaurant, tending bar, whatever it is, before you start shift, you don't have to sign a legal document saying you understand all the hazards and then set up a communication and transportation plan with the EMTs on scene to make sure that you're safe. If you were in the private sector and they're like, all right, Bob, here's the EMT for the day. Here's their qualifications. We need you to sign this document that everything you're doing is super hazardous. And if someone does get hurt, here's how you have to operate. Here's your escape routes. And here are all the local hospitals and medical flights that are available to you before you start your job. Okay, cool. Have a great Monday. We'll talk to you at the end of the day. Most people would be scratching their heads being like, what? Why do I need all of this? This seems super, super dangerous. Well, the fact is that it is. So this Sawyer was struck after the tree hit the ground. The EMT started rendering care. And it says the Sawyer was then transported via agency vehicle to the hospital in Springville, Arizona, where after diagnosis, they found a broken fibula and three broken ribs. It says up to an 8-week recovery for this individual. And I'm going to talk about this incident further once the more extensive report comes out on this. Now, again, this is just the last couple weeks where these incidents have taken place. And that mirrors what's been taking place on wildfires as well. Very, very hazardous. There was a hot shot that took a spill out in Tennessee, I believe. I'll cover that on the next segment as well, where they took a nasty spill out in Tennessee on a wildfire. All of those people were getting paid hazard pay, but it still doesn't take away from the hazards, but you're being compensated for it. So let's go down the list here. Let's start with a JHA. And for people who don't know that or have never heard of a JHA, this is something in the wildfire world and other places where there are hazardous jobs, such as oil rigging and other things like that, where they give you something called a job hazard analysis. And this is a document that the participants in the activities that take place during that job or on that job site, they have to sign it. And that says, I have gone over all the hazards of the job and how to mitigate those things and accept that what I'm doing is hazardous. So the simple argument here is, why am I filling out and signing a document that needs to be tracked and input into a system for legal reasons, dealing with hazards every time I go on a wildfire, and I'm not getting paid hazard pay? Like, that's an easy one, right? That's an easy argument to make. It's just apples to apples. You're making me sign a legal document, and some will argue, hey, it's not a legal document. But if you get hurt on a prescribed fire and you haven't filled out a JHA or no one provided that for you, believe me, people in the office start freaking out. And they're saying, where's the JHA? Did they sign it? Is it in the binder? Did you put it in the binder? Has it been logged yet? And if it moves its way to litigation, guaranteed the government's going to take that document and bring it to court and be like, listen, they signed this document saying that there are hazards to this job. And then really the defense could say, well, then why aren't they being paid hazard pay? That's standard in our industry to fill those things out. Now, the next argument I could make towards this is another easy one to make, which is retention. And there's documented evidence that hazard pay or providing hazard pay increases retention within your ranks. And then that snowballs into ultimately saving money. But as long as I was fighting fire and now you're in the off season, and specifically once you reach those supervisor levels of lead or squaddy or foreman or even superintendent, you are asked to do more on what we call the shoulder seasons or the off season. So you finish your fire season and then you chill for a little bit. You clean stuff up at the office. Things slow down slightly. And then you make yourself a cup of coffee. And the next thing you know, the duty officer is back in your office saying, hey, look at all these burn units or look at all these prescribed fire prep acres that we have to do. You know, next week we're going to put together a short squad or we're going to put a mod together. And we're going to go out and we're going to take care of all of these things. For a while, it's hard to get some people on board for that because you're just getting base wage. And now you're being asked to go back out into the fire environment and deal with all of these things. And it caused a lot of tension when it came to retention because folks are like, well, hey, I wanted to go ski. I wanted to go to the beach. And there's the payoff isn't there for them. And what does that snowball into? It snowballs into getting less acres done, creating more overgrowth in your forest because these things aren't getting done. And then it creates a retention problem where, you know, you'll get a few disgruntled people who are like, man, I'm out here cutting and I'm out here digging line and I'm only getting base eights and it's a commuter. So, you know, my meals aren't getting paid for like I was on Wildfire and I'm spending gas and so on and so forth. And a lot of folks don't know that this sort of thing adds up. Like, we already know that a lot of wildland firefighters live out of their trucks or camp near the base. And the point being, this can take a toll on retention. And as I said at the top of the show, even Idaho, the governor of Idaho came out and said, you know what, we're going to actually start paying our employees hazard pay because we're having a massive retention problem. And this was just last year of 2022. And it says on Thursday, the governor signed into law up in Idaho legislation giving the state's wildland firefighters hazard pay. The reason being, they wanted to boost the pay for their employees to keep more firefighters on the job. The Republican governor signed the measure that provides Idaho Department of Land's wildland firefighters with hazard pay of up to 25% above their hourly wage. And in that statement, the governor said, hey, we have a retention problem. We're asking our employees to stay longer into the fall and earlier into the spring, which both the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service are doing as well. But higher level managers and fire supervisors in Idaho said, hey, like, you're asking us to do all this prescribed firework, and this is the new push nationwide. The Forest Service chief, Randy Moore, just put out a letter talking about how we need to do more prescribed acres. We need to finish more prep on burn units, and we need to keep more employees on to do this sort of work. Well, you're going to lose people unless you compensate them appropriately. So you can make the argument that prescribed fire helps with retention if you give them that hazard pay. And again, the argument will come up, and I've heard it all. Like, I read your guys' messages. I hear what you're saying. It's like, just increase the base pay. It's like, yeah, I understand that. Like, that's what I've been shouting from the rooftops for a really long time. That has seen progress. But now we're in the off season where these sort of things come up. Now, the argument then shifts to, could this ultimately save money? And folks will say, well, how do you save money by spending more money? It goes back to that retention thing. If you get someone fed up enough to where they're going to leave after 2, 3, 4 years because they're working for $15 an hour, $18 an hour with a 45-pound pack on their back doing very hazardous work and their buddy next to them is getting smoked by an aspen tree and breaking their fibula, you might start thinking, oh man, like there's a line for everybody. There's a cutoff. There's people out there who'd be like, you know what, I'd be cool doing this if I was making hazard pay. If I was getting $26, $27, $28 an hour, you know, this would actually, I'd be actually a little bit more cool with this. So when these employees leave, you also have hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxpayer money that went into training these people that goes out the door. And now you hire new people and you have to then put hundreds of thousands of dollars of training back into these new individuals to get them up to speed and how to operate as a wildland firefighter in these environments. That alone would save, it's on the back end. So a lot of people wouldn't see that up front and be like, oh yeah, we're saving money from, you know, paying a little bit of hazard pay and keeping people around. It's because those training budgets are oftentimes forgotten and the hours that go into training these individuals is oftentimes overlooked when you lose an employee or have to bring on a new one. How else could you save money? Well, you could argue that if you implement this, you then keep more people on, and then you could get more acres done. So if you get more acres burned in the shoulder seasons or the off season, one could make the argument that over a few years, you could reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfires in the areas that these things are taking place, thus reducing the cost to suppress these wildfires, which we all know cost billions and billions of dollars a year. The other thing that comes up that is kind of an inside joke within the wildfire world, and New Mexico experienced this with the Calf Canyon and the Hermit's Peak, and I've been involved in a few up in Montana and out in Idaho, Utah, other places. And I know there's people who have been in the industry that have seen stuff like this as well. You're conducting a prescribed burn, right? And things get a little squirrely. The wind kicks up. You have a wind shift. There's a couple spot fires that get out. Now it's burning up some acres that you didn't want to burn in the first place. And then the questions start coming up. Hey, are we actually going to declare this a wildfire? Should we call this a wildfire? There was actually a case that took place up in Montana this fall. And a lot of you sent messages to me about this. If I remember correctly, it was in or around the Bitterroot, but I'm not going to say if it was or not, but perhaps it was, where you have a prescribed fire, get a little squirrely, and now you're asking firefighters to sleep on the line to actively suppress this thing, but you go to the district office and you say, hey, no, I'm not going to declare this a wildfire because then we'd have to pay overtime, then we'd have to pay hazard pay. And again, you're creating a disgruntled workforce because you're actually having them suppress a wildfire, but you're telling them it's not a wildfire. One of the most active and severe wildfires I've been on, you can actually see it at the bottom of every Substack post that I put out there, that banner image of the highway with the trucks going down and the massive plume bending across the highway as we're driving towards this fire. That fire, when we arrived, was a prescribed fire. And I don't even know if this information is really widely known out there, but it was. And when we showed up, they're like, hey, this is still a prescribed fire. We're still on prescribed fire budget. We're not going to call this thing a wildfire because it will cost us a lot more money. And then we have to pay people hazard pay and things like that. And we don't want to do that. It caused all sorts of problems. Number one, we were set up there and they're like, hey, corral this thing in. And it became an inside joke while we were digging line that this isn't a wildfire. While like trees are torching around us and, you know, like we have established safety zones and escape routes. They just kept hammering in, hey, this isn't a wildfire. This isn't a wildfire. This is just a prescribed fire. And then we go into town to go buy your corn dog and your tobacco and your Choco Taco. And the public would be like, what's going on the mountain up there? It seems they said they were going to do a prescribed burn and it sure seems like it's getting big. But you're like, yeah, it's not a wildfire. You know, it's not a wildfire. And then the thing blew out and you ended up having all sorts of problems. My supervisor at the time popped off at the IC, went into a yurt and almost went fisticuffs with the guy. Because it was blatantly obvious that they were playing the game and playing the system. So where's this all going? It's a big deal to call a prescribed fire that escapes a wildfire because everything changes at that point in time. There's all sorts of legal issues. There's all sorts of other things like that. But specifically, there's a lot of financial and budgetary issues as well. I think it's a hazard to not declare an escape prescribed fire a wildfire for a lot of reasons. Number one, you're basically lying to the people on the ground. You're now asking them to do what is considered a very hazardous job, but without paying them hazard pay. And the IC is playing politics and trying not to ruffle feathers because the local newspaper might show up and say, hey, they burned up Mr. Johnson's property because of their prescribed fire. If you have hazard pay on a prescribed fire and it escapes, it alleviates the stress on that IC to be like, this is going to cause all sorts of budget problems. It's going to cost thousands of dollars more because I'm going to have to start paying everyone who's on the ground here hazard pay if I declare this. And it's going to cause all sorts of other issues. So I think it will ultimately help transparency and honesty in the industry when it comes to, hey, we messed up, or guess what? The weather turned on us, which you can't control the weather. Some would argue that you can with different systems that I've talked about before, but ultimately you can't control the weather and the wind shifts and now you got all sorts of problems. It might be easier for the people in positions of power to be like, it's a wildfire now, let's just switch gears and try to suppress this thing. Now there's two incidents that I wanted to highlight showing that yes, there are dangers to prescribed fire. Just in 2019, there were two high-profile fatalities on prescribed fire. And it's a slap in the face, I think, to everybody to make the claim that these things aren't as hazardous as wildfire and you shouldn't be compensated, even though it is the same work. It's the same work. So if you look at it back in 2019, wildland firefighter Daniel Laird, who worked for the U.S. Forest Service as a helitac captain, was killed in a helicopter accident on March 27th. The captain was one of three people in a helicopter that crashed during aerial ignition operations on a prescribed fire in the Sam Houston National Forest in Texas. The pilot Morgan J. Kozlowski and the passenger Kelly Callahan were injured. The privately owned helicopter was under contract for the U.S. government. Captain Laird worked for the Tahoe National Forest in California and left behind a wife and a daughter. He was serving for the U.S. Forest Service for over 23 years. Then the other one that happened in 2019 was a biologist that died during a prescribed fire out in South Carolina. And this is one that I actually reported on and talked about. So this gal was out what we would call ringing trees. And what that means is you find what we would call a habitat tree or a tree where you would see wildlife inside of or nesting in. And in this case, they were trying to protect the red-cockaded woodpecker. Nicole Hawkins was the biologist who was then ringing the trees. So that means you find the tree, and then you take fire, and you slowly burn around that tree so that the fire works its way away from that tree. So when the main fire reaches those areas, that tree is not impacted or is not impacted heavily enough to where it would burn down. It says that Ms. Hawkins was operating an ATV or a four-wheeler, and it was equipped with a power torch. The power torch pumps a small stream of diesel and gasoline mixture through a nozzle where it is then ignited. So she was driving around on a four-wheeler with a flamethrower on the back. I don't know about you, but that seems like hazardous work. A lot of folks will say, well, during prescribed fires, we have more precautions in place. We have, you know, backup plans, and we have tertiary plans, and we have things that mitigate the hazards more than we can mitigate them on wildfire, so then you don't deserve hazard pay. Well, that was broken in this case. It says most times Ms. Hawkins was paired with another worker, so you were always buddied up. But occasionally on prescribed fires, they would only send one member off to go do something, quote, quick, and then come right back. Ms. Hawkins said over the radio that she was going to light around one of the red-cockaded woodpecker cavity trees and would be right back. It's not clear what time she said that, but 11:30 a.m. is when others knew she was working on that task, and all were in communication with each other for the next few minutes. At 12:14 p.m., she came across the radio and stated she was heading out of the burn area. One of the other firefighters parked his truck on the route she would be taking to wait for her. That's common practice. You call in and say, hey, I'm about to bump out of here. Can you meet me on the road? And then someone rolls up in a truck, and then that's where you make contact. It says at 12:23, the firefighters noticed a column of black smoke, which was different than the white smoke normally produced by a prescribed fire. Black smoke means things are actually really cooking now, and it's not just burning surface materials. It's now getting up into the trees. It also could be indicative of maybe a piece of machinery on fire. At 12:28, crew members tried to reach out to Ms. Hawkins, but she did not respond. One of the workers found Ms. Hawkins on the ground next to her ATV, which were both on fire. At that point, she was presumed dead. The period in which she last contacted anyone on the radio until the discovery of her body was just 13 minutes. The dark smoke was seen 8 minutes after her last communication. OSHA, who did the investigation, did not determine the cause of the accident. Now, due to the hazards involved in this type of operation, they had a backup plan. And that backup plan was they had something called a man down button on their radios. And what that means is there was a certain button on all of their radios where you push it, and if you hold it down for 2 seconds, it sends out an emergency response sound or beacon, and then people will come to your aid, and you can quickly get to the person who's hurt, and probably hurt because there were hazards around. Well, guess what? That system was actually shut off. It says in the investigation, the radios the firefighters carried on the chest harness had man down buttons, which when pressed and held for 2 seconds would notify the people that there was an emergency, and it would provide location and internal GPS receiver information. However, the man down system had been deactivated for several weeks after they started getting false alarms. Following the fatality, they decided to turn the system back on. It's clear that prescribed fire or RX fire or even just prepping these units are as hazardous as wildfire. It is also true that the agencies and the administration have given billions and billions of dollars to increase the amount of prep and prescribed fire that's going to happen across the United States in the next 5 to 10 years. So there's money for fuel. There's money for trucks. There's money for drones. There's money for even catering. A lot of these larger burns, they have started implementing, bringing in teams and bringing in catering as well. The Stanislaus National Forest this spring had one of the largest prescribed burns, or at least a prescribed burn operation that folks had seen in a very, very long time. And there was conversations coming out of that being like, well, why aren't we getting hazard pay? This is basically a wildfire. Why aren't we getting paid overtime? This is basically a hazard fire. And ultimately, some shifts and some changes were made to appease the people who were like, we're going to walk. We're going to take off because what are we doing here? So there's all this money to go around, but we're still not willing to pay and admit to the workers that this is just as hazardous as wildfire. And again, this is like the main push of the administration and the agencies right now. We have to get that done. There was just a summit out in California talking about how you need to do more prescribed burning and you need to get more fire on the ground. There's been an ongoing conversation for years about retention, which I have talked about. You would probably increase retention if you provided this pay for these types of projects that happen in the off season. You may ultimately save money because of training and other things, and you might get more transparency when it comes to, hey, has this prescribed fire become a wildfire or not? And you don't play as much budgetary political games about, I'm not going to declare this thing a wildfire because then it's more paperwork and I have to deal with the budget and pay and get everything shifted over. You eliminate all of that. And then you eliminate the bitterness when your fire does escape or your prescribed fire does escape, and you start asking district people to sleep on the line, spike out, make sure this thing doesn't get any bigger, start firing operations off of roads to corral this thing in. And all the while, these people are not going home to their families, and you're paying them a base wage. Like, that's a problem. I'd like to know what other people think about this and your comments on it and kind of see where folks are when it comes to all of this. Because I think it's a worthy conversation to have. They are trying to fight for it in Congress right now. The NFFE is working towards it. Grassroots has talked about it as well. And, I've been hammering this for a while now. So I think it's a valid argument. And there's more pros industry-wide. Even the argument of you could probably get more acres done because you'll keep more people around. There's tons of pros. What are the cons? The cons are the budget. But as I've said, they almost shut the government down because of, quote, the budget. But then they've spent $2.3 trillion in the last 6 months. So that's a tough argument to make to counter what I'm saying here. But I'll continue this conversation. As I said, I'm interested in what folks have to say. Stay tuned for the entrapment conversation coming up next. And it's a short little brief, but the hotshot that was injured out in Tennessee, I'll cover that at the top of the segment. But I'd like to take this time to thank all the Substack subscribers. As you'll tell, as you're listening to this, I'm 100% ad-free. I don't have people sponsoring me to put on this stuff, to write the articles, to do the podcast, to update everybody on global wildfire around our beautiful planet Earth that we have. So I rely on Substack subscriptions to allow me to take the time and do this sort of thing. If you want to help out or you want to be a part of that community, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that monthly subscribe button, and that helps everything that I do. And when you do that, you get all the workouts, all the podcasts, all the articles, and are automatically entered into all the giveaways that we do as well. So thank you to the small group of people that do participate in that. I have a massive amount of free subscribers. We're talking 15,000 plus at this point in time of people that are on my mailing list that get everything that I do. But it's just a tiny, tiny fraction of that that do pay that monthly subscription. So thank you very much to those that do that. And if you'd like to participate, just go to thehotshotwakeup.substack.com and click on subscribe.
I have traveled this year over all the United States, through the Alleghenies, the White Mountains, and the Catskills, the Rockies and the Bitterroot Mountains, the Cascades, the Coast Range, and the Sierras.
So there was another entrapment out in California on the Williams Fire. And this is the second entrapment report that has come out in a short period of time. You also have the firefighter that was injured recently out in California trying to climb over a fence, got hung up and fell into the flames. So as the season continues on and we push into December, there are still areas in the country where we are operating on wildfires and injuries are continuing to occur, and entrapments in November are happening. Before I dive into the details of that, I just want to quickly cover the incident that took place out in Tennessee with a hotshot who was injured on a wildfire out there recently. It's just a quick little update from the Lessons Learned Center talking about how it occurred. There's no big update on it, but I thought it was worth covering. It says a crew member on an interagency hotshot crew fell during fireline operations on the Troublesome Hollow Fire out in Tennessee. The crew member was transported to the hospital and diagnosed with a concussion after a CT scan and MRI. So it had to have been a pretty significant fall to where you are being affected that much. They're putting you in CT and MRI scans and really checking on your head and your brain to make sure there wasn't a bunch of damage. So I assume that in this fall, there was a pretty hefty spill and they cracked their head pretty hard as well. I just wanted to update that. There have been one or two people who've reached out and been like, there's people getting injured out east. Have you heard about it? It's like, yeah, yep, I heard about it, but there's not a lot of information. But that's the information that we know. Now, with the entrapment that happened out in California, I might try to push through this kind of quickly. We're already almost 45 minutes into this podcast, and you know it takes twice as long to edit these things. So, but I'm going to cover all the information that is out there because I think it's important. And this is just one of those scary situations where your equipment gives out on you and you have to try to think fast and be on your toes and figure out how you're going to survive because you thought you had the availability of a truck to get out, but that truck doesn't work. It says on Friday, October 6th, at approximately 15:20 hours, the Williams incident occurred in the San Benito Monterey unit of the Cal Fire area. It says an engine was attempting to gain access to the vegetation fire when it became inoperable. As the fire progressed, it became established in a drainage below the engine's location. Nightmare status, worst case scenario. Like, that's the worst thing that could happen. It says the crew deployed two engine protection lines to defend their position while the fire burned through and past their location, causing them to seek refuge on the passenger side of the apparatus. A fire captain and two firefighters suffered burns. All three were transported via air ambulance to Fresno Regional Medical Center and were later released. So just some quick details on what took place. What were the temperatures? Where were they? What was the humidity? All that good stuff that you want to know when you're talking about these incidents and when you're arriving to a wildfire. So it says the burnover location was located on a long single-lane dirt road that transitioned from a mid-slope to ridgetop road. So this is some meandering one-lane dirt road, which is classic to these California fires and other fires out west. And it was mid-slope, so it's kind of wrapping around the mountain, and it worked its way up to the ridgeline. The temperature that day was 96 degrees. They're at an elevation of 1,340 feet. The relative humidity was 19.7%, so it wasn't crazy dry. Like, yeah, it's dry, but That's not like critical levels by any means. It was a lighter wind at 4 miles an hour out of the southwest, and they had clear visibility at the time. If you can imagine those sorts of California fires, it was that ceanothus and manzanita brush component, which gets very thick. And then you have that oak overstory of these tall oak vegetation that just is everywhere and is incredibly, incredibly thick. The fire behavior when this happened, it said the fire on the lower slopes was influenced by slope and fuels. So this is just a classic fire moving in the direction that the fuels and topography allow it to move. The overall rate of spread was approximately 1 mile per hour, with flame lengths averaging 14 to 20 feet, and they're getting that coming off of that brush component. When the fire reached the upper slopes, the winds had more of an influence and increased the fire's progression across the slope. Spotting was minimal and short range when it occurred. Now, the engine that became inoperable was a 2009 Type 3 engine. For the specifics, it was a Model 34HME. Now, in the report, they talk about the initial size up and things like that, but we're going to bump ahead a little bit in the timeline. And it says at 1600 hours, which is 4 o'clock for people who don't read military time, it says a CAL FIRE battalion chief arrived at scene and transitioned command of the fire. Working in coordination with air attack, they accessed a dirt road southeast of the fire and attempted to scout the road for fire resources to access the fire. The road being traveled by engine number 2 had no threat of fire impact at the time that they began driving on it. Fire Chief 1 noticed the fire had spotted over the ridge and found another dirt access road with a chain across it that led down to the head of the fire. The chief was going to use the road to access the black at the head of the fire to start suppression efforts. While Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2 were cutting the chain to access the road, the fire chief attempted to engage the four-wheel drive in anticipation of possibly needing it as they transitioned across the dirt road. Totally standard. Happens all the time. Even on hotshot crews or, you know, any sort of crew, you'll get a call on the radio from the truck up front and they'll be like, hey, we should probably drop it into four-wheel. We might need it. So total standard operating procedure. After completing the sequence to place the engine in four-wheel drive, the fire chief heard an audible alarm. This audible alarm indicated the engine did not engage the four-wheel drive, and subsequently, the engine became stuck in neutral. The fire chief reversed the process and attempted to sequence at least 3 or 4 more times without success. So stress levels are already rising. You're pissed off at your engine because it's not doing what you want it to do. You're stuck in neutral and you're just trying to suppress this wildfire. So the heart rate's increasing and you're probably starting to get a little bit pissed off. After Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2 cut the chain and got back in the engine, the fire chief attempted to place the engine back into two-wheel drive. The engine continued to sound the audible alarms. The fire chief attempted to place the engine in two-wheel drive again without success. So now the two firefighters who have jumped back into the cab of the engine are looking at you being like, what's going on? What's that alarm? Oh, shit. Or maybe it's happened before and they're like, oh, yeah, it does this all the time. But it's just adding to the stress of the situation because you know that you're stuck. Like you're stuck there. It says that they released the air brake to allow the engine to roll backwards a few feet, hoping the engine would realign the gears and engage into drive. Smart move. Probably something I would have done and a lot of you would have done. It's like, hey, let's just get this thing to roll back a little bit, see if we can catch a gear. The engine remained in neutral, and the fire chief then attempted a hard reset. This included turning the ignition off, switching the battery to off, and waiting approximately 1 minute. Okay, savvy move by a veteran to try to figure out how to get this thing to reset. The fire chief then began the engine startup process, hoping the engine would go back into gear. He attempted to work through the problem for approximately 10 to 20 minutes before the fire conditions deteriorated. Realizing that they were unable to get the engine to move and recognizing engine 2 was blocking the main access road for the fire, the chief contacted the battalion chief and advised the engine was out of service and requested a bulldozer. The fire chief was planning to have the bulldozer push or pull the engine out of the way. the battalion chief began making access towards the engine when the fire chief told them to turn around and go back down the hill as the engine was blocking the road. Shortly after, the call went out for an out-of-service engine. Okay, so now you're pissed off, you're stressed, you got a broken piece of equipment, and you're sitting in a road that's blocking access to the fire. Like that sounds like a horrible situation. 14 minutes later from when we started our conversation, 14 hours, or 4:14 in the afternoon, the chief continued to communicate with AirTAC, and an air tanker drop was made across the knob behind the engine. The fire chief requested through AirTAC that another drop be made to the north and on top of the engine. So we're already thinking ahead. We're already saying we're in a tight spot. This thing isn't moving. If I want to try to save this apparatus, you might as well put a retardant drop on top of us. The chief quickly and systematically assessed multiple different options as the fire was observed making a significant run towards their position. Again, your stress levels are going through the roof, and you're thinking to yourself, oh shit, I'm in a bad spot. The chief gave clear direction for firefighters 1 and 2 to escape the cab and put on their PPE, including their web gear. The chief pulled the 1 3/4 inch double jacketed driver side pre-connect, which is a hose, and a 1 1/2 inch single jacket driver side bumper line before they attempted one last time to get the engine into drive with no success. At that point, the chief observed the fire cross the road behind the engine. Okay, so now you have your egress is cut off. And it's like, well, now we can't go back because the fire is now on both sides of us. And an important part of this conversation is the cut bank on the top side of the road is like 10 or 12 feet high. So if you've been in these situations, one, it's hard to navigate that. And two, it's going to make for increasing fire behavior as it crosses that roadway. You're going to get some pretty high flame lengths going up these steep banks. Firefighter 1 extended the pre-connected cross lay to the back of the engine. So at this point, they're pulling out all the lines. They're pulling out all of the, what I would consider hard lines, or lines that are physically connected to the engine at all times. A lot of people would call these protection hoses, but they're used for other things as well. The chief gave direction to both firefighters to stay together and stay at the front of the engine. The chief re-entered the cab and engaged the main fire pump on the engine. The chief exited the cab, charged up the 1 1/2 inch line, which was on the front bumper line, equipped it with a high-efficiency nozzle, and began extinguishing the fire that had reached the edge of the road. So we're at the point now where the hoses are extended, the fire is crossing the road behind them, and now the flame front is coming up directly across from them, on the road where this engine is basically a paperweight. As the chief began cooling the side of the engine began to heat up and off-gas from the radiant heat. So all of the things that can melt are starting to melt, and those fumes are starting to come off the engine. The chief then considered the option of sheltering the crew in the cab of the engine, but decided not to because the cab became untenable. Because if the cab became untenable, they would have nowhere to go. So basically, he didn't want to put them inside of a coffin and be like, this is where we are. We're staying here. This is what we got. The decision was, no, we're actually not going to do that. The chief then told both the firefighters to stay at the front of the engine as fire activity increased and conditions worsened. All three began seeking refuge on the passenger side in front of the bumper. All three were forced lower and lower to the ground until they were forced to seek refuge underneath the engine. So now you're just in the worst spot possible. You're screwed at this point. You're probably saying your prayers and thinking to yourself, how the hell did I get myself into this situation? And then you remember, oh yeah, my piece of shit engine broke down, and now it's just sitting here. The chief wound up on the ground behind the driver's side front tire and under the front axle. He continued to spray water toward the rear driver's side, knocking down the impinging flames, while both firefighters continued knocking down the fire on the passenger side of the engine. Firefighter 1 continued spraying water in a fog pattern from the passenger side of the engine when they experienced a sudden loss of water pressure. Another nightmare. You're battling flames that are melting your engine, and then all of a sudden your hose goes limp. It's just the worst. The chief also recognized that they had a limited water supply and did not want to lose what water was left. So the chief got out from under the engine and attempted to shut off the pre-connect connections. The chief experienced an extreme amount of heat and immediately took refuge back under the engine. As the other two firefighters began taking on more heat, the chief again directed both firefighters not to leave where they were. The chief continued knocking down what fire they could from underneath the engine. So you're basically laying prone underneath the engine, spraying outwards, you know, hoping this thing passes quickly enough to where you're not going to get, you know, severely injured or killed. Through the entirety of the event, the chief continued to reevaluate all the available options before deciding to stay with the engine. Even with the increased fire activity, the chief considered what tactic would provide the most safety for the crew. So this individual, the chief, is running those what-if situations constantly through their brain. What if this happens, then this? What if this happens, then this? And you're making those secondary and tertiary plans for when your primary plan goes south. Considerations were given to seeking refuge in the cab, also deploying fire shelters in front of the engine or walking away from the engine and continuing on foot up the road. The chief felt none of these options were the safest given to fire conditions at the time, being unsure where the road led and if it would be overrun by the fire. The chief decided the best option was to keep the crew together and stay under the engine. While constantly reevaluating the situation and their options, they felt the fire environment was becoming unbearable. This unbearable environment lasted approximately 20 seconds before conditions began to improve. So there was a 20-second moment that was memorable enough to where it made it into this report where they thought to themselves, it's over. There's nothing else we can do. We're screwed. But they also admit that that only lasted 20 seconds, but I'm sure it was the longest 20 seconds of their life up until this point. The entire fire impact event occurred over an approximate 2-minute time frame. When the conditions began to improve, a bulldozer with a heavy equipment operator arrived at the burnover site. The heavy equipment operator checked on the engine, the crew, and asked if they were okay. The heavy equipment operator stated that the hose bed covers were on fire, and the chief requested that they be put out. One of the firefighters and the heavy equipment operator used the 1 3/4-inch double jacketed hose from the passenger side on the front bumper to extinguish the hose covers. At that point, the battalion chief arrived and loaded all the firefighters up to take them back to ICP. As the battalion chief began backing the vehicle down the road, the fire chief began updating the supervisor with a number and extent of the injuries that had occurred. At 1620 hours, so a total of 20 minutes from calling in and saying the engine is broken to now, emergency traffic was requested, and one ground ambulance and one air ambulance were requested to the ICP. A short time later, the battalion chief requested 2 additional ground ambulances and 2 air ambulances, so they called the world, which is appropriate in my mind. At the bottom of the hill where the dirt road meets Lockwood San Lucas Road, the fire chief exited the vehicle to allow for more space for the injured firefighters. He began walking towards the ICP when they were given a ride by a passing water tender. At 1639, all 3 injured firefighters arrived at the ICP, also known as the Incident Command Post. Their personal protective equipment was removed and treatment was started on all 3. All 3 of them were transported, loaded into air ambulances, and flown to Fresno Regional Medical Center for further care. All personnel received treatment and were later released. Throughout the entire incident, the command presence and calm demeanor from all involved in the situation played a pivotal role in the positive outcome. Upon further evaluation of E2, or the engine, it was discovered that E2 experienced a critical electronics failure in the body control module that prevented the engine from moving. It says that the fire chief suffered second-degree burns to the face and hands. Firefighter number 1 suffered second-degree burns to their right arm, right shoulder, and right leg. So obviously that was the part of their body that was closest to the fire. And firefighter 2 had respiratory injuries. The engine itself received major damages. The lessons learned that came out of this report, which I think are pertinent and should be tossed out there, are: one, with the increase of electronically controlled equipment, have a plan for when the equipment failure occurs. Now, I'm going to make a swift point here before we move on. As I've covered on the Substack before, the Forest Service has mandated that all vehicles be electric within the next just few years. I believe it's 2027 for small trucks and shortly into the 2030s for the larger apparatus. Those are totally electronic and will have all sorts of issues when you implement two things: one, water, and two, fire. And guess what? If you had an electric engine that started on fire, you couldn't shelter underneath it because those things burn intensely for very long periods of time, especially if these lithium-ion batteries explode and start on fire. You can't even put those things out with water. So I think that's important to note there. Number two, effective situational awareness, leadership, and communications were a clear contributing factor to the positive outcome of the incident. Again, this goes to cohesion and having retention within your programs. You build the trust with the individuals you work with to not run away, to not try to jump into the cab of the engine, to listen to the commands of, hey, we need to stay underneath this engine, fire up the hoses, fog out around us, and let's ride this thing out. Number three, being alert, keeping calm, thinking clearly, and acting decisively, and a constant reevaluation of the situation reduced further injuries on the crew. And that's something that's taught to every wildland firefighter. Good communication was maintained between the engine crew, air attack, and the IC, which is great to hear. Effective use of limited water supply, proper water application, and technique contributed to the positive outcome of the incident. Upon notification, the IC acted immediately by declaring an emergency traffic, controlling the radio traffic, and requesting appropriate resources. Now, something I want to point out in those last few is having water left in your tank. When I started my wildfire career, it was in Montana. I was on an engine, just a brush truck, where we would catch all these IAs and run and gun, and then I transitioned into the hotshot world. But it was hammered into us. Hey, you got to keep... It's been a long time. I think it was 100 gallons. You got to keep 100 gallons in the tank at all times. And the question would be why? And the answer is, well, if we get trapped or we're surrounded by fire, we want 100 gallons to use to try to protect ourselves in the engine. That's standard operating procedure for the different typings of engines. I'm sure that varies where, you know, how much you're going to keep. But you always had someone watching the tank. So if you were hydro mopping, which if you don't know what that is, it's where you just stand on the fire and spray as much water as you can. There was someone watching the tank being like, yo, I'm shutting this down because we're down to 100 gallons. We need to go refill. And in that process, we still want water left over in case we get caught in a tight spot. The second is, don't always think that your ingress egress is going to be good. You know, shoving these trucks into four-wheel drive, a lot of the times this sort of thing happens where you have trouble, it gets stuck in neutral, your truck goes into limp mode. Everybody who drives these apparatus or fire trucks around these dusty, hot conditions knows that these things are really quirky and the electronics go bad. And again, a lot of that's from the dust that comes up on these dirt roads and it just cakes on and you end up having electrical issues. So have that secondary and tertiary plan to get yourself out of these situations. Man, I can't stress enough the staying calm, thinking clearly, and acting decisively. That will likely save your life if you can manage to do those things, if you have also implemented these other things that we've talked about. Panic will kill you, straight up. And that's just not even in the fire world. That's in your personal life. If you panic in your personal life, believe me, things just get worse. So stay calm, think clearly, act decisively, and make the decisions that need to be made to get yourself out of these situations. A lot of the times, you'll hear these reports in passing, and you'll be like, well, what the hell were they doing there? That's stupid. It's probably their fault. They were on a mid-slope road. That's dumb. But then you get into the meat and potatoes of it, and it's like, well, their engine just crapped out on them, and it failed, and the entire, you know, piece of equipment that they relied on just stopped working. And so, again, I like to read these things out and have the discussion because you can learn a lot from these things. And again, from the Lessons Learned Center, you get a lot of information on these sorts of things. I hope folks out there were able to take away from this, learn something, or at least run through your mind these sorts of situations. And even the conversation about hazard pay, I hope it gets people thinking and having these conversations about why it's important, not just because, hey, we need more money, which, believe me, I've been fighting for that for a very long time. But there's also a lot of pros that can come out of that. And I just want to spark these conversations because I think it's important, especially if you're going to be fighting for this stuff in Congress. Again, I'd like to thank all the Substack subscribers. None of what I do is possible without you. I know there's thousands and thousands of people that listen that are not subscribers monthly. And, you know, maybe there's a few of you out there who want to support the community or want to support what I do and keep these things coming. If you want to listen to other podcasts, I put a tremendous amount out on the Substack, and that's where all the articles are as well. So if you want to support the community or the Hotshot Wake Up, just go to the hotshotwakeup.substack.com, click on that subscribe button, and that supports everything that I do. On that note, reach out to someone you haven't talked to in a while. Say what's up to your homies. See how they're doing. Get that exercise. Go outside, stretch, hydrate, eat those quality calories. Get the rest you need because you need that to recover. But when you get up, you got to get it done. Uh.